Welcome to Inclusion Unlocked, where we explore the changing equity, diversity and inclusion landscape, bringing you fresh perspectives, lived experiences, practical tips and next practice. I'm Sasha Scott and I'm the founder and CEO of The Inclusive Group. We're an equity, diversity and inclusion consultancy in the business of behaviour. Alongside our guests, we'll be exploring challenging topics and focusing on real action, considering the practical steps each of us can take, whether we're leaders, HR practitioners, or colleagues, to unlock inclusion in our workplace. And today, I'm joined by founder and managing director of Edit Development, the awesome Sonia Bate. Sonia founded Edit in 2010 as a DEI consultancy grounded in keeping it real and empowering people to be the very best they can be. Sonia is a much sought after keynote speaker, facilitator, and executive coach, who has, over a decade, led the way when it comes to gender diversity and women in leadership, working with some of the world's largest and most progressive organizations. So we're going to be diving in deeply into topics that can be challenging to speak about, from privilege and why some people find the word in and of itself so triggering, to political correctness, and whether our fear of saying the wrong thing is preventing us from making any progress on diversity. So hold on to your seats, get the popcorn out, as this promises to be a deeply important conversation, full of food for thought and valuable perspectives. Okay, well, welcome everyone. I'm super excited to have Sonia as our guest on Inclusion Unlocked. And I'm really excited about this conversation because we go back a long way, and it's just fantastic to have you sitting on our virtual sofa. So welcome, Sonia.
Thank you for having me. I've said to you when we were first talking about doing this conversation, it's not something I do very often, but if I was doing it with anybody, it would be with you. So I'm looking forward to this as well.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Right. Well, I'm going to go back to the beginnings of Edit and a little before that. Since setting Edit up in 2010, obviously your business has grown into a really respected leadership development consultancy, working with over millions of people in some of the world's largest organizations. But what I want to do before we dive into that is take you back to life before Edit. Can you give us a little bit of insight in your early career and what prompted you to set up that business?
Well, was the life before Edit? I think that's probably the first one. There definitely was. And you made me sound like a rock star then with all of your build up in terms of the business. The reality is, I am the working class kid done good. You know, I really am, you know, in terms of backstory. And that's really important because so much of Edit and who we are and what we do, and me actually, in terms of so much of who I am and what I do today, all of that started because I was the kid that didn't fit in. You know, just didn't fit in. And I think there was something about discomfort at school, discomfort at college, discomfort even at university to some degree, and then into the workplace, into corporate structure. And I just never felt like I found a place where I really fit. And then if you don't fit, what do? Start something that you set the tone of. And I think that really is the true backstory as to where we are, and probably the passionate bit around inclusion and fighting for the underdog. You know, I was always the kid, even at school, that if there was a bully, I'd go and sort the bully out, because you're fighting for that underdog all of the time. And that's never gone away for me in my entire story, really. So that's the background to where, why in 2010 I said, enough of this now. Now it's time to go and create something different.
Okay, great. And that takes a lot of courage, Sonia, to do that, to jump into a space and start a business. I mean, did the fear ever make you question what you did?
I think fear, for me, makes me question what I do every day. But in some ways, I use it to drive me. I'm quite risk averse, which for those who don't know me very well are really surprised at, because I'm quite out there and I'm very experimental and I'm not afraid to try new things. But actually, when it comes to life, because, you know, I started off in humble means, I've always been very financially risk averse. So leaving a job and leaving a salary and setting up a business, Yeah, there was a lot of fear. And, you know, my partner and I've got, you know, a really great support network around me. But yeah, there was definitely fear. But I think I've used that fear almost to charge me. And even today, Sasha, the reality is there's days when, you know, I think, oh my God, you know, how am I going to do that today? Or, you know, how am I going to deliver that? And then you just crack on. But I also don't take myself too seriously. And at the end of the day, if I do something and I fail, of which, can I tell you, in my nearly 50 years, I keep keyword 50 next year. So nearly 50 years, I have had probably as many failings as I've had wins. And I'm all right with that, because I think that also drives that learning mindset in terms of the way you show up.
Absolutely. And I think that for a lot of humans, there's a real discomfort to talk about failings, but it's failing forward, isn't it? It's with that mindset that says that what can I learn from that? It's the most human thing in the world. But I think it's unusual for people to be able to acknowledge and sort of almost celebrate those failings. So I think that's fantastic. Really, really fantastic. Okay, that's super interesting. It really is. Particularly the courage it takes, but it, for me, you have always come across as someone who's impassioned about what you do. And that passion is like a driving force, isn't it? Absolute driving force.
I think so.
So I'm going to go to another. Yeah, go on. Go on.
No, I was going to say, yeah, the vulnerability piece. I think in society, and you know, you and I have had these conversations in the past, we tell people that to be successful, you need to just, you know, don't show the cracks in your armor. And actually, for me, the cracks in your armor is what makes you unique, right? And the vulnerabilities that sit around that. And I try to do that with my team now. Like, it's okay if you get stuff wrong. It doesn't matter. You know, we're not doing brain surgery, right? So there's something about it's okay if you get things wrong, but just make sure you learn from it and then refocus when you do something next time.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And again, it's that leadership piece that you said just now. I don't take myself too seriously. And I think that then sets a tone around how everyone is human in edit. Everyone is human, and people can talk to each other. And there's just a humanity about the way in which the business runs from what I can see. And it starts at the top.
And a lot of laughter. There's a lot of laughter when you're in Edit Towers, Sasha. That's the reality. There's a lot of belly laughs that go on day to day.
Excellent, excellent. Well, that's really important. My goodness, isn't that important? So I'm going back to Edit again. And obviously, Edit's got a really strong track record when it comes to women in leadership and empowerment of women. And we've obviously got a really long way to go before we go anywhere close to gender parity. But in your view, where or how have organisations been getting it wrong when it comes to gender diversity? I know it's a huge question, but what is it that distinguishes organisations who are actually doing good here?
I think maybe that's how I'll frame it then, if I may. It's just, you know, what are people doing that's adding value?
Yeah.
I think, and you know, you probably see this, you've got organisations who go after the numbers game. So it's a numbers game. I'm at 20%, I want to be at 23%. I'm at 23%, I want to be at 28%. And again, let's be candid. If you are going after a numbers game, there are very specific things you can do to move your numbers. You know, targeted career progression, targeted sponsorship, you know, really thinking, who is my pool? And now what do I need to give the pool to ultimately move them forward? It's backdoor positive discrimination, if we're being really candid around.
Yeah.
With very talented people still. That's not to say this is not about not got high capability. But the numbers game is one approach. Where I've seen companies do it really well, and you know, we've got so many great organizations who choose to work with us who do this, they've not focused on the women in isolation. What they've done is focused on the women around helping them understand what they want, actually. And you know, let's be candid, that's not even whether you're a man or a woman, but just helping leaders and future leaders to figure out what they want is a necessity for all of us. But what they've done brilliantly is they've said, okay, let's work on career progression and maximizing potential for the individual, but let's work with the line managers, let's work with the skip level, let's work with the culture. And were organisations, we're seeing shifts, real shifts in the numbers, but not because it's a numbers game, because they're working on psychological safety in the culture. They're working on a speak up and a speak out environment, zero tolerance of poor behaviours. And then again, anybody that's ever worked with me will know, I fundamentally believe and have always believed that women are over-mentored and under-sponsored. And therefore, it's working on the sponsorship in the environment. But I am not a fan of forced sponsorship programs. In my opinion, they don't work. I think what works well is when you build an infrastructure that focuses more on organic sponsorship and an organic spotlighting of talented, you know, women or men in an organization to help them move forward. So to come back to your question, the companies who are doing this really well, they're not going after it as a numbers game. Yeah. And what they are doing is saying, we're not trying to fix the women. There's nothing to fix. We are helping individuals understand their potential and we're working on the environment. And, you know, we've been really privileged to get that balance right with companies of let's work with the line managers, but also let's work on supporting those individuals around what they want. And therefore, I think that's why we've had so much success, because it's not fix the women. Like, I hate that phrase, you know, the fix the women programs drive me insane. And we just don't do them. You know, if a company wants to do that, then they won't work with us. They can go work with somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the whole language around fix, it intonates that there's a brokenness around it. And I completely and utterly agree with you. And we're very aligned, I think, as to businesses in terms of our view of this. And if you're just adopting a programmatic approach to get from, you know, 20% to 25%, you're not really going to go in the right direction at all. It's got to be far more holistic and far more cultural. And so I'm so interested by what you just mentioned around sponsorship, organic sponsorship. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? What does that look like?
Yeah, of course. I suppose if we talk about sponsorship, I think there's a lot of confusion around what sponsorship is. And I think people talk about mentoring and sponsorship interchangeably. So they'll say things like, oh, you know, we want to sponsor people. And then when you look at what they're doing, it's just a good old fashioned mentoring program that's been, you know, badged as sponsorship. Yeah. For me, sponsorship starts with exposure. If you want to get organic sponsorship in an organization, you've got to start with exposure. So exposure, how do I get access to my boss's boss? How do I get access to their talent partner, the decision makers, the multiple stakeholders, which will have an influence over what happens to my career? And that's the reality. You know, in a business today, in a corporate structure in particular, it's not your boss and your boss's boss that get you promoted. It's the entire system around those people. So it starts with exposure for me. Mm-hmm. I've got to get in the room with those people, you know, virtual room. The second part, for me, it moves from exposure to visibility. So, all right, I'm now in the room with Sasha, who's my line manager. She doesn't really know me. She doesn't know what I want. She doesn't know my strengths or my passions or my values. So now how do I build visibility with her? And that, for me, starts to move this moving towards advocacy. So it starts with exposure. Now we're building a relationship. And I think, for me, the heart of sponsorship is trust. And then we move from visibility. I'm in a room with Sasha. I'm working with Sasha. Okay, now Sasha's starting to trust me, and now that's moving into advocacy. So even when I'm not in the room with Sasha, Sasha's got my back. She's being the voice for me even when I'm not in the room. So for me, organic sponsorship is that. It's how do I help populations that are underrepresented? And you could take this away from women and look at other underrepresented groups in some businesses. How do I move this from exposure to visibility to true advocacy? And let's be honest, Sasha, it's no different than in our world and with our equivalents in other organizations. I've been an advocate from you for day one, and you're an advocate for me. But the reality is you're not going to advocate for somebody that you don't trust. Well, you might, but I won't. So there's no way I will advocate for somebody unless I trust them. Mm. And how do we create that for people in organisations? And I think that's the gold dust. You know, when people say, what's the silver bullet? The silver bullet is create visibility and exposure, and then hope that moves into advocacy and sponsorship.
Yeah, I really, really, really agree with you there. And I think the key thing there is the trust building at the very beginning, isn't it? Trust is a currency as well, isn't it? It's something that has to be earned often, or it's an instinctive, I trust you. And there's an affinity around trust as well. But I think that's why I think it's really much easier to sponsor people like us in terms of our own affinity bias than to sponsor and mentor. And I absolutely agree with you that there's a real confusion around the two. People who are not like us. And for me, when I think about sponsorship, it's the things I say about you, Sonia, when you're not in the room. It's that advocacy, what I say about you when you're not in the room. And I think that, you know, what you've shared is also incredibly powerful for anyone listening into this, thinking, I'm starting on my career. What do I want to achieve? How can I go about that? How do I build those steps as well? Sort of self-advocacy piece. I think that's really, really important.
And I think it works. You know, for me, there's two other layers to that as well. One is that, you know, we often say, who's advocating for me? How do I build sponsorship? But, you know, one of the things I often say to people, that's all very nice, but why don't you try advocating for somebody else? So I think, you know, for me, a part of this as well has to be, as you're moving your career forward, surely we should be looking to the side and looking behind us and advocating and lifting other people. People did that for me at the start of my career. And I know I said earlier, you know, in every organisation I've worked, I never truly felt like I fit. That doesn't mean I didn't work for some great leaders who lifted me, who challenged me, who saw things in me that I didn't even see in myself. And I think that's advocacy as well, is that people push you. Some of my most challenging chapters in my retail and in my finance days, I worked for leaders who were really tough leaders. And at the time, I was like, you know, I'm just not loving this. But fast forward, they were my most teachable moments and actually made me what I believe is the leader today, because they saw things in you that you didn't even see for yourself. And coming back to your affinity and bias point, Sasha, wholeheartedly agree with you. We are more likely going to advocate when there's common ground. You know, we're more likely going to advocate when somebody's recommended you. So, you know, if I didn't know you and somebody said, you should talk to Sasha, if I trust the person who's recommending you, I'm more likely going to trust you from the beginning. So you've got, you know, networks and systemic networks at play. You've got personal bias at play. You've got how comfortable I am with common ground and vulnerability at play in all of these conversations as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just want to move to sort of focusing on what we hear and see now, you know, as we reach towards the end of the year in this space of equity and diversity and inclusion. And we've both seen a huge amount of change in the last 20 years that we've been doing this. What I feel very, very conscious of, and I'm sure that you will also reflect on this, is a lot more fear and anxiety. And actually, we've started really having some quite uncomfortable, hostile situations just in the course of what we do. And it's not surprising, because what's out there is inevitably going to be in workplaces, and I think a lot directed against people in this space as well. There's also, I think, a very strong sense of political correctness from some people that feeling that, you know, this area has gone way too far, the pendulum swung too far. And, you know, I'm just would like to talk to you about respectful dialogue in, you know, the sort of cancel culture environment that we're in. What's your sense of the space that we're in at the moment around fear, anxiety, political correctness, and conversations that you could be cancelled or shut down?
I think it's one of the biggest things that not only I worry about as a business, but also I see my team worry about. For me, there's three things at play. One is psychological safety has to go both ways. And I personally do feel like we've got to a point where everything is extreme. And therefore, what happens is you become silent. I know I have, you know, I see it, you know, we had some friends around for dinner on Saturday night. There was one side of the table who had very extreme views around what's going on in the world right now. The other side of the table had very extreme views. I found myself not saying very much, unheard of, might I add, but I found myself not saying very much because I was like, if I say that, am I going to be, is it going to disrupt the conversation so far? Because these two extreme views can't find the centre ground. And if I take my dinner party on Saturday night as an example, we've lost the art, in my humble opinion, of finding middle ground. And therefore, what's it doing? It's driving silence, because it's easier to just not say anything than to get it wrong. And I know I felt like that on some particular topics, even as an expert in my field, there's been some topics over the last few years when I've thought, just not going to go there with that conversation because I'm not going to get it right. Because the other person, no matter what I say, it almost feels like they're looking for a discourse that's not a healthy one. And the thing that for me, we need to try and find, and we're working with some organisations around this at the moment, is honest conversations. Just, you know, I love the Kim Scott's radical candour. You know, I just love it. I love that model because what we're saying is, you know, Sasha, you can have a different view. I can have a different view. It doesn't mean I don't respect you. It doesn't mean I don't care about you. It doesn't mean if you fall over, I wouldn't pick you up. It means that on this topic, we have a different view. And it feels like we're living in echo chambers where you have a different view to somebody. Forget it. They call you on Facebook, they block you on LinkedIn, and they slag you off on Instagram. So therefore, there's an element of, I'm just not going to say anything. And I think we, as professionals in this space, we need to help people to navigate back to just radical candor. I can respect you. I can care about you. I can practice empathy with you. Oh, and guess what? I can have a different view.
Yeah.
In light of a situation. So, yeah, I don't know one person right now who doesn't sometimes worry that what they say, they're going to get it wrong. And I see that with clients. I particularly see that with leaders.
Yes.
We had a leader who will remain nameless for the purposes of this, who got asked in a live television interview their position on whether or not they should, whether or not that if they had a member of their staff who burned a specific religious artifact, what their position on it would be in a live TV interview.
Wow.
You know, tell me where that goes. You know, I've had another leader who, again, in a live TV interview, got asked what their position was around gender identity, you know, trans rights, you know, just directly in an interview that wasn't even about that. No matter what that person said, there would be people who support them and there would be people who attack them. And that's where we've a little bit lost the art of having a different view.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really quite terrifying because it makes everybody super nervous and we don't learn or understand each other's perspective. So, as you say, siloed, polarized. And, you know, in the 20 years that we've been involved in this space, it's never been as hostile, I think, as it is now around those that sort of pitchfork mentality over things. And I think it's also exacerbated by people also doing this on social media in slightly, you know, hiding behind keyboards, 100%. And I just want to stay with language a moment. We both know that language is continually evolving. And with this, there are, you know, certain words that people feel deeply uncomfortable about. And I'm thinking in relation to this question about the word privilege. And I'd like to explore with you why people find the word privilege so triggering, and as practitioner, how do you manage people through that word?
Yeah, it's funny, I was having a very similar conversation to this with a client last Thursday. To be honest, some clients I stay away from the word. So we've got some clients who, do you know what? The triggering by using the word in a learning environment just derails the whole point of the learning. And therefore, I tend to replace it, or we as a business replace it, with the word power. Where do you get your power from? Do you get power from position, status, affluence, background, education? Just where do you get your power from? Power is a really interesting word. I find that very rarely do people have a reaction to power. I see it the other way, actually. They have a positive reaction. Oh, you know, you're asking me where I get my power from, as right, they start to lift the weights in the meeting, and, you know, peacock and the chest puffs out. So I think the power word is less controversial, but it also drives a very similar conversation. In some environments, I absolutely will go there with the word privilege, but I can see why it gets a reaction, because if I look at my own story around, you know, lack of economic access as a young person from a very, you know, working class town in the north of England, with the background and the backstory that I have, yeah, the word can be a trigger. It can be a trigger sometimes to me, because I'm like, I've worked really hard for where I am right now. But okay, I understand. I have white skin. I have a British passport. Used to have an EU one, but we won't go there with that. You know, you have a British passport. Yeah. There are things. Just look at what's happening around the world, like right now. You know, geography privilege is one that nobody ever talks about. But geography privilege is something that is live and well if you've been born in the UK. And I think the word hits you in your heart, because sometimes if you've had your own struggle, whatever that struggle is, you will say, but hold on a minute, I don't have privilege. I've worked really hard for where I am. And therefore, for me, we've got to unpick it. Let's not get stuck on the word. Let's get stuck on what we're saying. And what we're saying as, Sonia, the very fact you were born in the UK, you hold a British passport, you have white skin, you have blonde hair out of a packet, to be fair, but blonde hair all the same, gives you access to things that somebody else without those things might not have had. And I think that's the conversation we need to be talking about more. What's the impact? The word privilege can sometimes feel like you're hitting me with a stick, and therefore, again, I just won't go there. If that's gonna be 45 minutes of a 90-minute conversation, Sasha, I would prefer to have a power conversation and have a manager go out the room and say, right, now I know how to use my power, and that's a different dialogue.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. It's just more relatable for people, for many, many people, without distancing or getting someone's defensiveness, understandable defensiveness, to get focused on, because then the conversation just goes awry. Absolutely. And staying with conversations, when I look at the team that is at Inclusive Group and think about polarization, hostility, not very, very strong views on either sides of fence on multiple issues, I worry about what keeps them up awake at night, what keeps them awake at night. And I worry about actually putting them in the line of fire in terms of, even in professional environments, you know, we're noticing real hostility, and I want to insulate them. And the way we tend to insulate is by opening up questions, really creating hopefully an environment of psychological safety, and thinking and rethinking about positioning and who's doing what pieces of work, and really being approachable. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about your team, how do you insulate your team?
So there's been multiple things we've done, especially with people who are frontline client facing. So whether that's our, you know, the same with you, with your business, we've got our core program director group who are, you know, full time, they're in front of the clients all the time. And I mean, my word, you know, those people in our team, like in your team, they work at pace. You know, these are just incredible human beings. And then what we've got is our wider delivery team who are out there front facing, delivering the work. So we've probably got the, you know, the team, it's probably similar to you. It's got those two camps, the behind the scenes, the client relationship team, and then the I'm the one at the front of a room of 100 people talking about the word privilege. Or, you know, those particular extended edit team. I've done a few things to make everybody have a sense of purpose, but a sense of safety. Number one is the community that we've built. So we have a Teams community for our wider global team. Sasha, the energy in that team, it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal. The learning, the challenge, the fun, the safe space. You know, I had a particularly bad week a few weeks ago. And on the Friday, I was like, what's made you belly laugh today? And people were putting in their videos of, you know, you name it. And somebody sent me a message and said, is that video appropriate? And I said, if it's appropriate for you and it makes you laugh, absolutely. And I think number one for me is build a community. So it's not, you're not reliant on one person to pick you back up. You want to build this community of learners around it. The second, and I will always come back to this, and I think it's the heart of edit, laughter, fun, energy. You know, there's not most things in a day, in our world, most things in a day can be balanced, not resolved, but they can be balanced with laughter and balanced with tomorrow's a new day and we're going to go at it again. Like, I think that, you know, that second part is really key. The third thing is I'm really conscious, as is our program directors, about who we put where.
Yes.
Now, we will always try with our global team to have stretch as well as appropriate fit of capability in the room. And sometimes you'll put a facilitator in and it's a bit of a stretch. You know it's going to be a stretch. They know it's a stretch, but they want it as a learning opportunity. I'm all over that. But I might have a second person with them just so that they can chip in, support, be in the background. You'll have other people in the team who their capability is off the scale, like way better than me, like just off the scale of capability. You know that for those individuals, if they get real challenge, what we've done really well is empower them to make whatever decision they need to make in the moment. And I'll give you an example. We had one client. This was earlier on this year. Client's gorgeous. Love them dearly. There was one disruptor in the room, mobile phone out all the time, constant challenge, saying in the end inappropriate things. She timed it out. She said, either change your behaviour or do one. And the person said, well, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this programme. And she said, not a problem. Leave. And at the end of the day, she rang me and she said, oh, it's terrible. You're gonna have to do damage limitation with your client. You know, I won't charge you. Don't charge the client. I exited the delegate from the room and I said, you did the right thing by the client. Never mind me. You did the right thing by the client, because there was 24 other people in that room and they were having a negative experience because of one person. So the final word on that would be empower your people to act on your behalf in that moment. And again, if they get it wrong, because they will, I've got it wrong. If they get it wrong, coach them, learn from it, support them. And you can always not bill your client. Worst scenario. Key. Yeah. Worst scenario. You know, you can always not bill for something if it's not gone that well. But I find if you empower people and you're behind them, 99% of the time, things go well. And I think just that energy and support network is really important. And I don't know about you, Sasha, but people will ask me questions sometimes and I'm like, well, I don't know the answer to that. Same with a delegate. You know, they'll ask you a question. I'm like, why don't we look on ChatGPT for the answer to that? Because if you pretend that you know the answer for everything, you're setting yourself up to fail as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And not being authentic. And I think it is that humanity that we hopefully bring into the room that also says, yes, I'll get things wrong. But to your point around empowerment, I'm a huge believer in empowerment. I think that's not something that lots of business owners find comes quite easy for a variety of reasons. But I think it's so satisfying and joyous to see people grow and bloom and thrive. And our one of our roles, I think, is to curate that environment and let people fly, just fly. And actually, thinking about purpose and what's really important, and I appreciate we're always against the clock here, but Edit's got a very strong focus on paying it forward, and you are walking the talk through your role as trustee at the Minds Advisory Group, who frankly do incredible work. And I'd love to know what made you get involved, why that, tell us a little bit more about why that matters and what that's all about.
I mean, pay it forward to me, I can't even tell you where that started. All as I know is, even as a little girl, you know, my dad was a huge influence on me. You know, my parents passed when I was quite young. And my dad always used to say to me, you know, notice. The word that my dad used to say to me is notice. You know, notice the person sat next to you. Notice the person opposite you. Notice the person who's silent. Notice the person that's talking. Why are they talking so much? And that word, notice, for me, is why pay it forward is so important. I remember this very long story, which I won't go into now, but I remember one of my uncles telling me a story after my dad died about my dad, when he didn't have any money at all, but he saw some young man steal a chicken in a market when he was younger, and he said to the guy behind the butchers, "Don't ring the police. If he needs that chicken to go and feed his family, I'll get behind the counter and I'll work it off for him." Wow. And that pay it forward mindset was instilled in us as children. So from the very, very beginning, pay it forward is an interesting one, Sasha, because it means different things to different people. I can only tell you what it means to me. And what it means to me is notice and use your power, use your access to lift somebody else. That's what it means to me. And whether that's sitting on the board of a charity, whether that's doing free coaching, whether it's the person who's a delegate on the program who you see is struggling and you give them your mobile number and you say, "I'm here if you want to ring me." You know, pay it forward means so many different things to different people. But I'll tell you what we've managed to get right. There's not one person working under my brand who doesn't have the same ethos. And I'll be honest, that's how we recruit. We recruit on capability and pay it forward ethos. And if you don't have those two things, go and work somewhere else. Because the pay it forward element, I believe, is what differentiates us in the market. There's a lot of talented leadership specialists. There's a lot of talented inclusion specialists like yourselves. There's some brilliant companies out there doing some brilliant work. My job is to lift those companies, not shoot them down. And equally, my job is to find people working under my brand who have a notice mindset. Notice up, notice to the side, notice below, and then take action around it. So, yeah, pay it forward is, it's a huge thing for me. And all as I can say is it's at my core. It's embedded in me. If we were to stick a Blackpool rock, just saying, I don't eat rock anymore because otherwise I'd have no teeth. Not knocking Blackpool rock for anybody listening to this. But yeah, if I was a stick of Blackpool rock and you cut me in half or you smash me in half, it literally would say pay it forward. Wow. And I think, you know, that I think you've got to live it. I can't stand all this social media crap about, and when I'm doing this and I'm doing that. If you're doing it, get on and do it and stop talking about it. And I'm a believer in pay it forward action versus pay it forward noise. And I think for me, that's the important difference.
Well, I think that your dad would be unbelievably proud of you. Unbelievably proud of you. What a legacy. What an amazing human being he obviously was and you are. And I genuinely mean that. And I really think that mindset is so critical to create a happier world, a fairer world, and a world of distribution and equity. So, yeah. Sonia, thank you. It's been really, really interesting and thought-provoking and richly, richly informative to listen and to talk to you. Thank you so much for being our guest on Inclusion Unlocked.
Thank you. I've loved it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Sonia,
for giving up your time to join us on Inclusion Unlocked today and for being really open, candid, and tell it like it is. If you would like to hear more about how Inclusive Group can help your organization, we would love to hear from you. To find out more about our work or arrange a chat, please click on the link to the landing page of this episode and follow through to our website.